This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. When the Civil War ended, so too did slavery in the American South. A new book takes a look at the last generation of white Virginians who grew up with slavery. It suggests that these young Confederates, often depicted as firebrands, were perhaps more thoughtful about the Confederacy and politics in the Union than may have been thought. Peter Carmichael, who teaches history at UNC Greensboro, came to that conclusion after poring over letters from about 100 young white men in the days before and after the Civil War. Peter Carmichael's new book is The Last Generation, Young Virginians in Peace, War, and Reunion. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Well, the Civil War has been covered forwards and backwards. Everybody seems to have known the sides and has written about very many different aspects about it. And they say those sides were very clearly delineated. And yet you're writing about the last generation. Why that title, first of all?
Right. Well, you're right. The Civil War, there's been intense scrutiny of every aspect of the war, and particularly on the military side. But a generational approach gave me an opportunity to engage a number of very important questions about Southern identity, about why the war came, about how the war affected Southerners, and how Southerners then readjusted to reunion. So the generational approach was an important one because it gave me an opportunity to focus on the lives of young men who came of age just before the Civil War. The 1850s, when they became political beings, was a time of intense sectional political discord. And so these men had a unique experience when they came of age. And so they're an important group because of that, and also because of the role they played during the Civil War itself. They were prominent officers, Civil War officers, mostly in Lee's army.
So who were they, first of all? You say that you had looked over the letters of about 100 of these white Virginians. Yeah.
Letters, diaries, master's theses, also looked at university publications. I was able to get into the inner world of these young men. These young men were connected to the slaveholding class. Many of them were, in fact, members of the slaveholding class. We would consider them of the elite. And that really gives, again, us an opportunity to look into the worldview and how these people understood what it meant to be a Southerner, what it meant to be a Confederate, and what it meant to then re-enter the Union after the Civil War. So it was an important group, but these aren't the intellectuals, these aren't the politicians. In many ways, they do have a sense of being quite ordinary, average people. And I was very fortunate to uncover these master's theses, these university magazines and publications, because it opened up their intellectual world to me. And it's very difficult to get to that view by just looking at letters and diaries. So I was very lucky that the material really panned out the way that it did.
So paint a picture of them for us.
So a typical member of the last generation came of age in the 1850s, as I said, probably attended a university in Virginia, most likely the University of Virginia, was Episcopalian, and would attend the university for 2 to 3 years, often after that would either teach at a private academy or become a lawyer. And for some young men who couldn't find any career satisfaction in Virginia, they often left Virginia and they migrated to the West, usually to Arkansas, Louisiana, or to Texas. So that's sort of their general socioeconomic background on the eve of the Civil War.
And what was their take on slavery? That had to be, right. That was the overriding issue of the time.
It's absolutely central, and it's the one issue that often gets people very uncomfortable. Whether they have a supposed pro-Southern perspective or whether they have a pro-Northern perspective, people don't like to talk about slavery as something that's central to the experience of Southerners prior or during the Civil War. And that's really unfortunate because the only way to understand these young men is that they were part of a slave society. Now, it's true, most white Southerners didn't own slaves, but that doesn't take away from the fact that the dominant class in the South was they were slaveholders, just as today, even though most of us don't have the money of a Donald Trump, we live in a capitalistic society, and our lives are shaped and defined by that dominant ruling class. So to understand these young men, they were deeply influenced and shaped by slavery as an economic and social institution. And I think that what's crucial here, though, is that these men believed that slavery could, in fact, flourish in tandem with economic development, such as light industries, railroads, canals. They believed that they could coexist.
In other words, move away from the agricultural.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And in fact, they were exactly right about that, because not only in Virginia in the 1850s, but right here in North Carolina and in the Upper South, Tennessee as well, what was witnessed was slavery, in fact, was perfectly compatible with railroads, with industry. Slaves were being rented out and used in that capacity. So the notion that slavery would have died a natural death is, in fact, just simply not the case at all. And these young men recognized that. But at the same time, they were deeply frustrated because their personal aspirations were not being fulfilled at home. And they were also frustrated because the state of Virginia, long having the reputation as being the leader in the nation, they believed that Virginia's influence was on the decline. So there's a convergence of personal frustration about their own lives, that they're not able to achieve the status that their fathers had. And there's also frustration that the very state where they live is, in fact, people are making fun of it. They're mocking it. And what's kind of interesting is that Northerners were, in fact, more arrogant about the superiority of their way of life than Southerners. Northerners mocked Southerners for being backward, for being anti-progressive. And that stung these young men badly. And so what you see on the eve of the Civil War is that these young people, they want an opportunity to redeem their native land, Virginia. And slavery's crucial, indispensable to their understanding of their world.
You used the word progressive, and that came up in your book. It struck me, I speak about my own biases from more than a century later, and raised in the North as well.
But right.
You write about a progressive slave society.
Right.
And those three words together struck me as odd.
I'm so glad that you brought that up, because so many people get uncomfortable with that because they see the word progressive and they are not looking at it as a historical term. And it's important, and that's what I'm using it as how 19th century, not just Southerners, but Northerners define progressive. Progressive to them was simply this: a land blessed with material growth, with riches, a land blessed with republicanism as a form of government, and a land that was guided and steered by Christianity. So Southerners thought that slavery could, in fact, coexist and flourish with all of those things. Progressive, sometimes that word, it leads people astray, and they think that I am, in fact, trying to defend or say that slavery somehow was an institution that uplifted people. Absolutely not. What's crucial is to take the term on how 19th century Americans defined it, and they saw it much differently than what we do, of course.
So you spoke a moment ago about the frustration that these young men would have. They would be in their 20s at this point, in the 1850s or
right.
so. And so they have this frustration. Were they then the ones that really wanted to push the South into secession and then into war?
Into war. And, you know, that's what I thought that I was going to find, because I actually started backwards. What stood out to me that these young men, by the end of the Civil War, they were zealots. They were rabid defenders of the Confederacy. When it was clear that everything was on the decline militarily, these young men continued to believe that, in fact, the Confederacy would prevail. So I looked backward and I thought, well, these young men, they're Confederate crusaders. Simply, the 1850s, a time of sectionalism, a time of when young people were told, you stay in the South to get educated. I thought there must have just been a linear connection. That wasn't the case. When I looked at what happened in the 1850s, I found that, in fact, that these young Virginians were proud to be Southerners, they were proud to be Americans, and they were proud to be Virginians. They had all of these competing identities, and they all flowed together. Some became more dominant at times than at others. When it came, though, time with the question of secession, when it arose in response to Abraham Lincoln's election, and that's when these men coalesced as a political force and demanded disunion. But prior to Lincoln's election, these young men weren't out there clamoring in the streets for the South to unite and to leave. They simply didn't do that. They pulled the trigger once a Republican president, in this instance, a Republican president who opposed the expansion of slavery in the territories, that is what triggered their reaction to disunion.
Were they in the forefront of the cause for secession, or were they very willing foot soldiers for that? Were there older men that were pushing for that?
There were some older men in Virginia and in the South who called for disunion, but in Virginia, like North Carolina and like Tennessee, those states were really governed by moderates. It's the Deep South where you see the most enthusiasm and energy directed toward disunion. So in Virginia, yes, these men were in the forefront. And what I did is I took political acts that had long been really sort of discarded by people at the time and even by historians today as childish pranks, for example. Young people came together and they raised Southern or Confederate flags. Before Virginia left the Union, they did that on Virginia campuses. And these acts, these symbolic acts, were ridiculed by the Virginia papers, by adult society. They said that this is the work of boys who are running amok. But for these young men engaging in these flag demonstrations, it was clear support that their political loyalties had shifted from not just being an American now, but it shifted from being part of a Southern nation. So looking at these activities on Virginia campuses that, again, had often been just dismissed as apolitical, I saw that these were true political expressions and a consequence of deep thought, and not something that was just boys playing with fire.
There was no element in that, perhaps, of youth?
There is, and I'm sorry, I shouldn't overstate it.
Let's take up a cause.
And you sound like one of the readers who read this manuscript. You made the same point to me. Emotion certainly played a key role here, and we don't want to forget that. Cold Mountain, and many have read the book and seen the movie, but the movie, I think, does many things wrong. It does a few things right, but does many things wrong. And one of the things it does wrong is that it portrays Southern society as divided sort of between men and women. And Nicole Kidman, she looks at a group of men who are celebrating that war's finally come, and she says dismissively, basically, well, you've got your war that you've wanted. And what you see here is that there is just something sort of innate in men, that all this aggressiveness is just spilling out and they're rushing to the Confederate cause. There is a little bit of that emotion and that need for Southern men and for these young men to prove their masculinity. That's unquestionably the case. But to focus on that exclusively is to deny that they are, in fact, political beings, thoughtful political beings. So what I tried to do here is to not dismiss the role of emotion entirely, but to bring a little bit more complexity to how these people responded to what was an event that was incredibly significant in their lives. Mm.
What happened when they were no longer the young men, this last generation of whites who grew up with slavery after the war?
Right.
You track them in their later years, don't
you? I do. And again, that's the advantage of this book, taking the generational approach, is that we get to see how these men engage with these very traumatic events that have ripped the nation apart. But during the post-war years, what is so startling is that the survivors of the last generation, these rabid Confederates, within a very short period of time, within less than 5 years after Appomattox, they are in fact proclaiming their loyalty to Union. It's an incredible reversal. And so once again, we have an opportunity to understand political loyalties, culture, and nationalism. And quite simply, these men understood Northern armies, they had won the day. And in fact, they controlled the South. Militarily, they had the upper hand. There was no other alternative. And within that reality, white Southerners, members of this last generation, they recognized that to proclaim their loyalty to Union once again, that was a necessary step in order for them to regain power back in Virginia. In a sense, it's a cynical ploy, but it was one that was an absolute necessity. They felt like that they had no other choice. And it leads to what is so fascinating about the Civil War, is that we want to see the Civil War as a war between American brothers, this horrible tragedy, and that, in fact, Northerners and Southerners were all alike. And the war was just a great mistake created by politicians. And, well, let's look what happened at the post-war years and what the Ken Burns series, for example, at the very end, they show images of Union and Confederate veterans when they're old men shaking hands across the stone wall, the great divide at Gettysburg. Now we're all a united country again. As Americans today, we like to focus on those images, and we like to think that, in fact, there weren't these profound differences that divided this country. It was a great mistake, and we were all Americans. But what that overlooks, and I think the experience of the last generation attests to that, that after Appomattox, these, now not young men anymore, but older men, invented history. And they invented history for political means. They invented history by saying, look, we're all great Americans here. We respect our Northerners, who were once our enemies. They're our brethren now. They did that in order to get home rule, not just to rule over blacks, but also to rule over poor whites, who they didn't think were entitled to power. So history.
So if they hadn't done that, then what would have happened? If they hadn't said, okay, we're all one big country again.
Well, you know, that's, again, what is so amazing is that when we look across the world, and I am not a global historian. I wish that I were. I focus on the American South. But it does stand out to me, what little I know about the rest of the world, is that, in fact, in most civil wars, They don't go away gently, do they, or quietly. We're seeing that in Iraq right now. We're seeing that, in fact, that divide, that those battles continue, and we don't see that in the post-war South. And so what is striking to me is the degree of moderation that existed, not just in Virginia, but throughout the South after the Civil War. Now, I say that, and let's not forget that, in fact, there was tremendous violence. There was the formation of the Klan. There were Union troops that were still present in the South. There were open battles for power. But it's amazing to me that these young men and many other Southerners didn't take to the mountains and engage in guerrilla war. And so there is, in one sense, something to me admirable about the course that they pursued after Appomattox. From our perspective today, we can see that there's so many things wrong that they did, because ultimately what they pursued was policies that ended up in segregation, Jim Crow, and disfranchisement. They did horrible things. But there is another alternative here that they didn't take, and that was an alternative of violence and guerrilla warfare, and they did not pursue that.
How did you get so involved with the history of the Civil War? What was it that sparked it for you?
My mom took me to a Civil War battlefield when I was 3. I, of course, have no remembrance of that, but she claims that somehow got me going. And then they took me to a battlefield when I was 6, and I've been deeply interested in the Civil War ever since. I worked at Civil War battlefields beginning when I was 19, and it's a wonderful, amazing opportunity to engage average Americans and to see how they see their past.
You worked there as a National Park Ranger.
I did. That's right. I wear the Smokey the Bear's hat. And it's, you know, you give walking tours, you do research for visitors. And right now, the National Park Service, the Civil War sites, are going through a very intense and very interesting internal debate about how do we interpret Civil War battlefields.
Do they leave that up to rangers like yourself, or was there a certain script you have to follow?
See, that's just it. You're touching on what's really a really contested issue right now, because for some of the people who are historians who work at these sites, they feel as if that the people above them, the chief historian of the National Park Service and congressmen, are telling them what they should say on the battlefield. And what they think they're being told to say is, you need to talk about slavery, you need to talk about the coming of the Civil War, and you shouldn't talk about military events. And these frontline historians are feeling very besieged right now. That's not the message, actually, but that's the perception of the message. And so the consequences is a very interesting, heated debate as to how do we interpret the contested meetings of these sites. And for the frontline park historians, they got a tough job, because it's easy for us to sit back here and say, you need to talk about slavery, you need to talk about the coming of the Civil War. Well, do that with a group of strangers from all over the country, and you'll have quite a mess on your hands sometimes.
Have you ever had that happen?
I have had that happen a lot, and I've been fortunate that I spent so many years working during the summers at the Park Service that I felt like I was comfortable with what I could say, that I wouldn't really offend anyone and I could bring people together. But I've had people say horrible things not just about the South, but about the North. And what you really try to do is you try to get them to step back and you try to get them to see how that's really not a historical approach. And you don't try to shame them, you don't try to embarrass them, but you try to get them to see that there are other possibilities. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
Well, before we go, I want to note one more thing that I picked up in your book. You wrote that in the run-up to the Civil War, there was this animosity between the North and the South. And you mentioned that it wasn't that we were all one big brotherhood.
Right.
And there was somebody who even suggested an exchange program of college students from the South to the North.
Right. A student at the University of Virginia wrote in the literary magazine that it might be a good idea to get Southern students to go up north and Northern students to come down so that they could get a better sense of their cultural attitudes and behavior. That program never, ever took off, but it was an idea that was tossed out there. He said that at a time as a brave statement, because many Southern educators insisted that Southern youth needed to stay below the Mason-Dixon line to get a proper education. But once again, what did I find? That those who stayed below the Mason-Dixon line were not transformed into rabid fighter-eaters by their professors. They all loved Union. They loved the Union. They loved Virginia. They loved the South. But when, in fact, Abraham Lincoln was elected and the institution of slavery was threatened, that's when their sense of being Southern came to the forefront and their sense of being an American receded.
Peter Carmichael, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Peter Carmichael is an assistant professor of history. He teaches history at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. He is author of The Last Generation, Young Virginians in Peace, War, and Reunion. And he is a one-time National Park Ranger. Thank you.
Thanks.